I'm Eddie Alcohol.
And I'm going to have the honor of introducing tonight's speaker. I was so glad she said yes. I asked her a few months ago and been waiting, and I checked with her a few days ago because I hadn't heard, and I was like, man, I'll make sure she's, but we were on the calendar, and I'm glad because our speaker tonight, I met her last year, and she spoke during Recovery Month, I think it was, and just from what I heard of her, she's definitely a person in recovery who does not regret the past nor wish to close the door on it, but here's the deal is I know she realizes her past has made her into the outstanding person she is today. So you're gonna hear from her, and you'll know her a lot better in about 45 minutes. So Lisa W., come on up. Thank you. Appreciate you doing this.
Okay, good evening, everyone. My name is Lisa, and I identify as a woman of all A's, and I'm very excited to be here tonight and grateful that this is the first Friday, so I don't have to censor what I say. And I identify as a woman of all A's because I have belonged to many different 12-step programs throughout my recovery journey. My recovery journey started actually here at Ridgeview in 1981, and I did not stay in recovery way back then, but I've been committed to my recovery since April the 9th of 1989 by the grace of God and many 12-step programs, and for that I'm grateful. And my journey really began here at Ridgeview. I'm kind of going to tell my story a little bit differently and start with how I wound up here at Ridgeview back in 1981. I was 17 years old. I was pretty much in a tremendous amount of denial, but I had a really horrific experience. Really, this was my stomping grounds. These areas were my stomping grounds. I did a lot of drinking and drugging and a lot of other things in this part of town. And one night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was picked up by two men and was raped and left in the woods to die. And it was a very traumatic experience for me. And when I came to, I walked to a gas station, and the gas station attendant saw me and saw how distraught I looked and asked me if he wanted me to call the police, and I told him no, and I asked him if I could use the phone, and the first thing I did was call my drug dealer and had my drug dealer send a taxi to pick me up. And I went to my drug dealer's house, and my drug dealer let me have and do as much cocaine as I possibly could do. And I blacked out again, and the next minute I knew I came to was, and I was in Ridgeview. And I had no idea how I got here, but my family tells me, and I believe them, they tell me that I said they came, that my drug dealer called them and came over to his house, and that I told them that I wanted to come to Ridgeview. I believe them because they swear by that, but I have no idea where that came from because I didn't even know Ridgeview existed. I drove up and down South Cobb Drive and probably saw this place, but had no idea what it was. So for me, I look back on that now and see that that was really one of the first miracles that I was able to identify that happened in my life. When I was here at Ridgeview, I was actually put in Cottage C, and back then it was before insurance companies had control over your life and your medicine and your doctor's appointments and all that other good stuff. And so I was in Cottage C for about 3 months. And part of the reason why I was there for so long was because when I came in, the psychiatrist told me that I was a drug addict and that I needed to go to treatment, and I absolutely refused. I told him that I was not a drug addict, that was not why I was here, and I was not going to go to treatment. And he told me that he was not going to let me out until I went to treatment and until I went through Ridgeview's 28-day program. And at the time, like I said, I was 17 years old, but I had had so much life experience already at that point that they did not feel that it was appropriate for me to go to the young adult program here. And so they put me in with the adults when I finally agreed to go, because I realized I was not gonna get out of here unless I went through the 28-day program. So that's what I did. And like a good person in denial, I went through the program, I got out of here, and I drank the day that I left. And I had no intention on staying clean and staying sober. But one really important thing happened to me while I was here at Ridgeview. There was a young man that I was in high school with that got into a very serious car accident and became a paraplegic. And it was a Friday night meeting, he was here at the meeting, and we were forced to come. So I don't know if some of you were here because you're maybe in the halfway house and had to come, right? So we were forced to come, and when I saw him, I couldn't believe that he was alive, and I couldn't believe how well he was doing. I couldn't believe how happy he was, even after what had happened to him. And so that seed was planted, right? That recovery can happen. And I knew and I always felt like he was way worse than me. So, you know, that was pretty profound for me to see him. And so to back up, for the first 17 years of my life weren't any different than what happened to me the day that I was brought to Ridgeview. I really grew up in a very alcoholic, dysfunctional, codependent family. I could probably call my family a lot of other things as well. There was a lot of sickness, a lot of secrets in my family. I grew up in New York City and moved to Georgia when I was about 14 years old. But in my family, my father being the alcoholic that he was, and my mother being the good codependent that she was, really, they came from a lot of family dysfunction. And besides their own personal recovery or battle with their illnesses, you know, they brought in a lot of baggage from their families of origin as well. So I grew up with statements like, what goes on in this house stays in this house. You put your makeup on and you put a happy face on and you get comb your hair and you get dressed and you look like a million bucks, and nobody knows what's really going on inside or inside this house or inside you. And so that was made very clear to me. My father was a gambling addict. He was a sex addict. There was a lot of turmoil in my house. I was the youngest of three daughters. My oldest sister was a hippie from the Woodstock days, and so she turned me on to pot when I was about 8 years old. And that was the little thing that her and I did together, and she told me, don't ever do this anywhere else. Well, like the good, you know, addict that I am, you know, of course I did it other places. By the time I was 10 years old, I was suspended from school a couple of times for selling pot. I would roll pot up in strawberry rolling paper and bring it to school and sell it. So I was an entrepreneur right from the start, and that hasn't changed throughout my life. So that's where my entrepreneurial spirit began, was rolling joints and selling weed at school. And of course, you know, I became a good liar. You know, I got caught and got suspended and, you know, went home, and my father would say to me, you know, where'd you get this from? And I'd say, like a good alcoholic addict would say, somebody gave it to me. I didn't know what it was and asked me to hold it for them. And I put it in my locker and I got caught, and he believed me. And so, you know, my lying about my addiction started then. And so my dad always believed me, so I always got away with it. And so I learned that I could get away with it. By the time I was 13 years old, I was already doing, you name the drug, I was doing it. And at the time, I was still living in New York. And I had a lot of shame because I was the type of drinker and the type of drugs that I liked were downers. I would black out and a lot of things would happen to me when I blacked out. And so I had a lot of guilt and shame because I would come to in places and with people that I had no idea who they were and where I was. And so when I moved to Georgia when I was 14, I was thrilled to be having a clean start, a clean slate. Nobody knew me. I could come here and act like I was white as snow, right? And so I was really looking forward to that. But immediately I came, and we know how to find them, right? So I found the first person that looked like they sold some kind of drug, and lo and behold, I was back doing drugs again. Acid was really a big drug of choice of mine at the time. I remember driving from New York to Georgia. I was tripping on acid the whole entire trip. I have no idea how my parents had, they had no idea. So pretty clueless. My parents both smoked cigarettes, so they allowed us to smoke cigarettes. So at 11 years old, I was smoking cigarettes in the house with my parents and with my parents buying my cigarettes. So it was really easy to smoke pot in my house because I would just smoke a cigarette right behind it and they couldn't tell. And because my father was an alcoholic and there was alcohol always in the house, there was no problem sneaking the alcohol either. So I remember when I was, ninth grade. I don't know how old I was in ninth grade, probably 14 or 15. I was taking some class and we had to write a paper, a complaint to a business. And so my complaint was to the Heineken Corporation. And I made up this story how I had bought this case of Heineken and one of the six packs only were half full and blah, blah, blah. And so it was this business class. And this teacher let me send this letter. So I sent this letter to the Heineken Corporation. And the next minute, you know, I get a case of Heineken, a free case of Heineken that shows up at my front door. And so my dad was like, wow, where did this come from? So I told him about my letter. And so he let me drink the case of Heineken. So that is, you know, pretty much how my family was. Drinking was acceptable. My family, my mother was 100% Italian. Her family was from Sicily. My father was 100% Puerto Rican. So we did a lot of partying. As a young kid in New York, we had parties every single Saturday night. And so drinking was something that we just did all the time. And so, like I said, from 8 years old till the time I moved to Georgia at 14, I was already full-blown into my addiction at that point. So it wasn't a surprise that at 17 years old, when I'm walking down the street because I'm so drunk and who knows what drugs I was on that night, I honestly don't even remember, but I'm sure a lot of different drugs, that I make a bad decision and I walk down the street at 3 o'clock in the morning only to get picked up by those two men and wind up in Ridgeview. So when I got out of Ridgeview back then in 1981 and relapsed, I knew that my parents were gonna cut me off because they told me they would. And I kind of believed them, but I kind of didn't. So I felt like if I did whatever they wanted me to do, that they would not cut me off. And so my parents came to family week and all the stuff that they do for family. And while I went through that, my dad, being the good alcoholic that I am, I told the counselor that my dad was an alcoholic and my dad was a gambling addict and my dad had issues. I didn't tell the counselor about my dad's sex addiction because that was a secret between me and my dad that I was never to tell anyone, and I kept that secret almost till the day he died. And so my dad got confronted by the counselor about his alcoholism, and my dad decided, with the help of the counselor, to get sober. And so my dad got sober when I was in treatment here in 1981, and he stayed sober until the day he died. And so that was a great outcome of my treatment, that my dad got sober, and it really was a good thing for my family. But because my dad got sober, my mom went to Al-Anon. And so my mom started going to Al-Anon, so when I went through treatment here and then I relapsed, I felt, part of me felt like they were going to cut me off, and another part of me told me that maybe they might let me get away with it. But because my mom was going to Al-Anon and my dad was sober, I thought maybe I better do what they tell me to do. So my dad said, if you go to treatment in Mississippi, we will support you 100%. And so my parents, with the help of Ridgeview, found this god-awful treatment center in Jackson, Mississippi, that was an all-women's treatment center, and it was a 90-day program. And I was appalled, but I went, and I powered through that treatment. And it was a really rough 90 days. It felt like it was much longer than that. When I got out of treatment there, I went to a halfway house, and I did and was able to stay sober and was able to put together about 15 months of sobriety. I did come back here. I did relapse again, and I won't go through all of my relapses, but one of the relapses that I want to point out, because this was a very significant relapse for me, is when I was in the halfway house, something had happened at some point. I had gotten a prescription for pain medicine. The sober part of my brain knew, you better not take this pain medicine, but the addictive brain said, don't throw the prescription away. So I folded up the prescription really small and tucked it in my wallet. And then at one point, when we were having our community meeting, I decided to fess up about that prescription, and so I pulled that prescription out, I ripped it up, I threw it away, and I went to my community group that night and told them what I had done. And the house manager did not believe me, and so the house manager kicked me out. And so I was 19 years old, I was pretty devastated, and I relapsed. And I'm not blaming that house manager, but I will tell you that I did not have the coping skills or the emotional intelligence to handle that type of rejection that I got at that point. And so that started a very significant pattern for me of not really believing and trusting people in 12-step programs. And so I relapsed many, 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 many times. The total treatment centers that I wound up going through was 9. There was probably more than that. I remember 9, but honestly, there was probably more than that when you figure all the halfway houses, three-quarter way houses, detoxes. There were probably most definitely more than 9. So when I got to recovery this time, it was a lot of pain. So I, in and out of treatment, in and out of treatment, in and out of 12-step programs. My last treatment that I went through, I met my ex-husband. So I'll make that really clear, ex-husband. So we met in treatment. He started kind of flirting with me. I thought, no, I'm not going to do this again. So, because I always relapsed over boys, right? And the majority of the time. And so this time I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. So I got out of treatment successfully and stayed sober for about 6 months. And we ran into each other in a meeting and we started dating. And I invited him over to dinner. And when I did, he was in the bathroom and he was taking a really long time and I couldn't figure out what was going on with him. So I was calling for him and he wasn't responding. So I went and knocked on the door and he wasn't answering. So I opened the door and he was knotted out over the toilet. He had been in my bathroom shooting dope. Now, when I was in Ridgeview, the psychiatrist that I had said to me, Lisa, one day you are gonna be a junkie. And I told her she was absolutely crazy, that she did not know me. And you can imagine how I said it. You don't know me, you know, and you have no right saying that. I'm afraid of needles. There's no way I would ever stick a needle in my arm. Absolutely no. And so that night when Mr. Wright was knotted out in my bathroom and I was 6 months sober, I didn't call my sponsor. I didn't think about calling my sponsor. I didn't think about going to a meeting. I didn't think about kicking him out. The first thing I said to him was, I want to try it. And so there began my days of shooting dope. And so Dilaudid was his drug of choice, Dilaudid and heroin. And so we proceeded to start doing Dilaudid and heroin. And I don't have to tell you how that story goes, right? Lots of loss, lots of moving. You know, we were constantly moving from apartment to apartment. We couldn't keep a car, we couldn't keep an apartment. He couldn't keep a job, I couldn't keep a job. We'd move in with his mother, out into an apartment, back in with his mother. You know, we even moved to Georgia once thinking that we would come here and, you know, it would be okay, that geographical cure. But within 15 minutes of living here, we were downtown Atlanta, finding heroin, shooting dope, you know, driving back and forth from Marietta to Atlanta, how many times a night, it was crazy. And one of the things that happened that was very significant for me was I got pregnant. And when I got pregnant, the thought of not shooting dope never crossed my mind. And so I shot dope through both of my pregnancies, which is not something that I am proud of today, but it is part of my story. And it just, to me, reminds me of how sick I really was. And here's the thing, I love this part. I quit smoking. I didn't want to smoke. I thought that would hurt the baby, right? So I quit smoking through both of my pregnancies. So I thought I was doing a good thing. But that's how sick I was. I really thought that it was really more important for me to quit smoking cigarettes than it was for me to quit sticking a needle in my arm. I was so afraid that my children, both of my sons, would be born in withdrawal like my other friends' babies were. So I made sure that I quit 30 days before I delivered. And so that's the other A, right? The control, the Al-Anon piece, right? The adult child piece. So trying to think and thinking that I had some kind of control. And so I was able to stop shooting dope and was able to do it for the 30 days before I delivered so that my babies weren't born in withdrawal. And somehow that addict brain of mine made me believe that I had control, right? Because I did it. I was able to do it. And so, one of the things, you know, and many things happened while I was pregnant and after my children were born, but one thing in particular that was pretty significant that happened was when my first son was born. He was 6 months old. My ex-husband and I robbed a drugstore with my son in my arms, and we got away with it. And we later on got arrested, but after we had done all the pills that we had stolen from the drugstore, back then, you know, you could find a good country drugstore that had the pills on the shelf, And so we knew that, and so that we would go to these drug stores, and this one particular one, I robbed this drug store with my son, 6 months old, in my arms. And again, not something that I'm proud of, but it's part of my story, and it's something that really helps me remember how really sick that I was. When the police came busting down my door, telling me it was the pizza man, and came in, they looked at my young, poor little innocent soul and said, you know, wow, we don't want to take you to jail, but we have to. But if we take you to jail, your baby is going to go to DFACS, and we don't want to do that. Is there somebody that you can call? So I was able to call my best drug friend, and she came over and picked up my son so that he didn't have to go into custody, and they took me to jail. It was a very horrific experience for me to go to jail, to be away from my son, knowing who I left my son with. I had a lot of a tremendous guilt about that. I got out of jail and swore that I was not going to use anymore, and of course I did. So continued on, and son number two was born. I did not get into recovery until, like I said, April the 9th, 1989. My boys were 2.5 and 3.5. And the thing that really brought me to my knees, it wasn't taking my sons to downtown Atlanta and leaving them in the car with no air conditioning in 100 degree weather while I was in the dope man's house getting high, coming out 45 minutes later, they're red, they're puking. Nope, that's not what got me into recovery. What got me into recovery was in 1988, my mother was diagnosed with a very rare cancer at the time called multiple myeloma. It's not rare anymore, but back then they were just finding out about multiple myeloma. And most people that got multiple myeloma were people who were in their 70s and 80s. So they were really shocked that my mother had this particular type of cancer. My mother was 48 at the time. And so when my mother was diagnosed, she was told that she only had about a year to live. And so when my mother found out that she had cancer, she knew that I was shooting dope. And she said to me, she said, Lisa, please, please, I beg you to get clean before I die. And I really, really wanted to do that. But I really, really couldn't. And I really tried on my own, that control again, trying to get clean on my own. But this time I couldn't do it. I even went to the local church, went to the priest, told the priest everything that I was doing. I confessed all my sins, right? And said, please help me. What do I do? I'll do anything except go to treatment and go to a 12-step meeting. Anything but those two things. And so he told me to sit in the front row on the left-hand side every single Sunday and that he would pray for me. And I have no idea why I did that, but I showed up to church every Sunday on the left-hand side, the front row, so that priest could see me. And one day, I had a real spiritual experience. And what happened was my ex-husband was in prison. He broke out of prison. He came home. He found out that I had been, you know, shooting dope and doing other things. And so when he broke out of jail and hitchhiked back home, he proceeded to try to beat me to death in our house with my children watching this. I blacked out. I really don't remember what happened after that. All I remember was coming to, the police being there, and I just remember hearing this voice say to me, Lisa, is this how you want to live the rest of your life? And I just remember saying back to that voice when I was out, no, this is not how I want to live the rest of my life. And I could really see my kids and see my kids really hurting and suffering in a way that I could never see them hurting and suffering before. And so when I came to that day, I sat up and I knew that that day was it, that I was done. And they carted my husband, ex-husband, back off to jail. And that day, I packed up my stuff and my children's stuff, and I moved into a women's shelter, and I vowed to get clean and sober. When I moved into that women's shelter, the woman who ran the women's shelter told me that if I wanted to stay in the shelter, it was part of their program that you had to go see this counselor. So I said, fine, I'll go see the counselor. But in my head, I'm thinking, I'm not going to treatment and I'm not going to 12-step recovery, no matter what. So I go to the counselor. That Monday, I tell the counselor my sad story, right? How I grew up and the trauma and my parents and my ex-husband and blame. So told him my whole trauma blame story. And she looked at me and she said, you are a drug addict and an alcoholic, and I can't even help you until you have 90 days clean and sober. And if you want to stay in this women's shelter, you have to do what I tell you to do, and I am telling you that you have to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I left that counselor's office so pissed off, I can't even tell you. And I was walking down the street and I just thought, man, I just want to get high. I just want to say, screw it. And as I was walking down the street, I said to God, if you will take this feeling away from me, I will do whatever you want me to do. I just want to be clean and sober for my mother. And I had this overwhelming sense of peace from my head to my toes. Completely, I could feel this warmth start from my head all the way down to my toes. I felt this sense of release and relief and had no idea how to explain it. I went back to the women's shelter and I called my dad and I told my father what had happened. And remember, my dad's sober, right? And at this point, he had been sober for 3 years. Or no, more than that. He had been sober for 7 years. And I said to my dad, I said, I have no idea what just happened. And he said, Lisa, God is directing you back to the rooms of recovery. You need to go to a meeting. And I said, yeah, I don't know about that, but, you know, I hear you. And so my son got sick. And I started to call the pediatrician's office, and every time I dialed the number for the pediatrician, it was my old sponsor's voicemail tape answering machine that kept picking up. And I thought, that's weird. I'd hang up, I'd dial the number again, it would go right to her answering machine. And I called my dad back again, and I told him, I said, I'm calling the pediatrician's office, but it's my sponsor's house. Something's not right. And he said, Lisa, again, God is leading you back to 12-step recovery. You need to go to a meeting. So I decided I was just going to go to a meeting, just get it over with. I was going to do what this lady said. I was going to go to the 90 meetings in 90 days, and that was going to be it. And so I went to a clubhouse, walked into my first meeting, had my nice long hair with my hair in my eyes, sat in the back row so nobody could see me, and I thought, I'll know what I'll do. I'll go to an AA meeting, because most of my recovery experience had been in Narcotics Anonymous. And so very little had I gone to any AA meetings. So I went to a woman's AA meeting where I felt like I could hide in the back, and somebody asked me who I was, and I said, I'm Lisa, and I'm a drug addict. And I, so hopefully nobody would talk to me, right? I'm in an AA meeting. Back then, AAers did not like you to say that you were a drug addict, so I deliberately said I was a drug addict. And they'd hug me and say, we're glad you're here, keep coming back. And I was just taken back by that. What? This isn't supposed to happen here. And so one of those meetings, it was a speaker meeting, which I hated speaker meetings, but I'd go anyway. And there was a speaker that spoke, and her name was Judy. And when Judy stood up there, Judy told my story. And I just was absolutely blown away that somebody could say some of the things that I just told you today and say that without shame. And this woman had been through treatment 12 times. So I felt like if this woman could go through treatment 12 times, and she was standing up there, and she, at that point, she had been sober like 11, 12 years. She had been sober that long. This is somebody that I wanted to talk to. And so I went up to her and I asked her if I could call her, if I could talk to her. And I told her that I really wanted to be sober for my mom, that my mom had asked me to be sober and my mom was going to die any day. And she agreed to sponsor me, and she said, I will sponsor you. If you want what I have, you'll do what I do. And I said, sure. I had no idea what that meant. And so she started telling me, this is what you have to do. You have to go to 3 meetings a week. You have to go to a big book meeting. You have to go to a 12 and 12 meeting. And you have to go to an open meeting, discussion meeting, but all women's meetings. You cannot be around the boys. Boys get you in trouble. And I said, okay. And I did it. And I have no idea why I did it, but I did it. I listened to her. And she gave me such a wonderful foundation to my program that I still work today. One of the things that I love about her is she told me that, Lisa, if you want to grow, you will journal. And you will journal every day. And she told me to go to the drugstore and buy a green spiral notebook. And I think back then I might have paid a quarter for it. And got that green spiral notebook, and I asked her why green, and she said, because green is for growth, and if you want to grow, you will pick up that, you'll look at that green notebook, and you'll know that every time you pick that up that you're going to grow. And she started me journaling every day with simple things like a gratitude list. Then she started me in on reading the big book, a couple of paragraphs a night, because I dropped out of high school. I actually was kicked out of high school, all Cobb County schools. So my reading level was terrible. I really struggled with the big book. I struggled with any of these readings. I couldn't pronounce a lot of these words. And so she had me take the big book, couple paragraphs at a time, read them. Any word that I didn't know how to pronounce or didn't know the definitions for, she had me look them up. And she was prepping me, which I didn't know this, for my fourth step. So she was a very smart woman. And so she gave me such a wonderful foundation. And because of the foundation that she gave me, I was able to put together 6 months. I got the phone call that it was the end for my mother, and I drove from Mississippi to Georgia to come be with my mother. And when I got here, I went to St. Joseph's Hospital, that's where she was, and my mom was sitting up in the bed, she had makeup on, she looked good. I looked at everybody like, why did you call me? She looks great. And the doctor pulled me aside and said, every single bone in your mother's body is crushed from her cancer. And we have no idea why she's alive, but we think she's still alive because of you. And so you need to go in there and you need to tell her that it's okay for her to die. Because there's nothing holding her organs together because all of her bones are crushed. And that was a hard reality for me, and I had to walk in there, and I had never made amends to my mother. My mother, when she was dying of cancer, remember I told you I had a hard time in the beginning. I drove all the way from Mississippi to Georgia, and I stole her Dilaudid and lied about it. And I never made amends to her for that. I never made verbal amends, so I had a tremendous amount of guilt. So now I'm looking at my mother, knowing that she's gonna die any minute, but still very full of guilt, shame, and remorse, and could not make amends to her. And so I told my mother that I was 6 months sober. She was very excited, and I asked her, I said, do you mind if I leave tonight? They have a meeting across the street at Northside Hospital. I'm gonna go get my 6 month chip. And she said, please go get that chip. So I went over to Northside Hospital, I got that chip, I brought the chip back, and I handed it to my mother, and she lit up like a Christmas tree, and she smiled, and she said, Lisa, I am so proud of you. This is all I wanted. This was the gift that I wanted before I died, was for you to see you clean and sober. And she took that chip and she held it in her hand. And I left that night. I had to leave. There was an emergency back home. My ex-husband had relapsed and left my children at the daycare center back in Mississippi, and nobody was there to pick up my children. So I drove all night home to Mississippi to get my children from my neighbor who picked up my children from the daycare, because my husband never showed up and was off on a binge. And my intention was to drive back to Mississippi, pick up my kids, and turn around and drive back to Georgia. When I got to Mississippi and picked up my kids, I decided to take a little rest and take a little overnight nap, 4 hours, 5 hours, and then I was going to get in the car. When I woke up, I got the phone call that my mother had passed. And I was absolutely devastated. I can't even tell you. But what I was told by everyone that was there was that my mother deliberately looked around the room to make sure that I wasn't there so that she could die. And I believe to this day that my mother felt like she had to be strong for me, and she wanted to be strong for me, and she did not want me there when she died. I drove back to Georgia, gave my mother my 6 month chip, put it in her hand, in her casket, and that is where my chip still is till to this day. And I promise you that I am still here 34 years later because of my mother. When my sobriety has been precarious and maybe a little scary at times for me, when I thought maybe I might relapse, I feel like my mom was there squeezing that chip for me, helping me hang on. Sobriety, my sobriety recovery journey has not been easy. It has been very challenging. I had to divorce that husband that was very physically, mentally, emotionally, and verbally abusive to me. I was a single mom. You know, I had, like I said, had been kicked out of all Cobb County schools, so I had a GED. I was a single mom. You know, I didn't know how I was going to take care of my kids. I had no job, no money. But by the grace of God, I will tell you, my journey has been just amazing. And so I stand here, you know, all these years later, you know, from 6 months when my mom died to, you know, 33 and a half years later, I'm working on my fifth degree. I'm working on my PhD. I'm grateful that I am a nurse. I work in a wonderful profession. I went back to school, got my undergraduate, went back and got my master's, went back and got another master's, went back and got my doctorate in nursing practice, and now I'm back getting my PhD. And I did that, and I do that not for any other reason other than really my life's mission to this point, and my life's passion is to help as many people find recovery as possible. And so my specialty is, where I work, is in addiction medicine, and I am absolutely have dedicated my life to recovery, because I know that the junkie that I am, the alcoholic that I am, the adult child of an alcoholic that I am, the codependent that I am, the all the other A's that I am, the only way that I am going to stay on this path is to be absolutely 100% committed to recovery and inundated in this fellowship. And that may not be your story, but that is my story, and that is what has worked for me. I have had to work on my trauma. I've been in therapy since I was 10 years sober. And so I've been in therapy continuously for 24 years, and I don't plan on stopping therapy. It's been very painful dealing with my trauma, and more trauma has been revealed to me the longer I stay sober and the more that I work on myself. But it has been worth every single minute that I have spent, you know, going through those tough times and going through and understanding myself better. So I stand here today a sober, happy, healthy woman in recovery, with a beautiful life. I'm living a life beyond my wildest dreams, and I know that the only reason why I stand here today is because of my recovery. And I would like to end with my favorite passage in the AA Big Book, which is in the story, The Keys to the Kingdom. And one of the reasons why this is my favorite is because my very first AA sponsor used to say to me all the time, when my self-esteem was so low and I didn't think I was worth anything or I could ever become anything, right? She told me, Lisa, God wants you to have the keys to the kingdom. And so I'm going to end here. It's on page 276. The last 15 years of my life, and I'll say the last 34 years of my life, have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems and heartaches and disappointments, because that is life. But also, I have known a great deal of joy and peace that is the handmaiden of inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together and sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love without strings, without an obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is now gone, and never to return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted, needed, and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lisa. That was an incredibly powerful story.